A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been watching the annual summer ritual. Forest fires sweep through the eastern Mediterranean. Local teams get overwhelmed, and then something quietly remarkable happens. Countries that don't exactly send each other holiday cards start sending planes. Greece helps Israel. Israel helps Greece. Italy's in the mix. Cyprus, too. And what's got him curious is the machinery underneath that. Not the heroism, but the actual process. Who picks up the phone? What gets said? How a request for help moves from a burning hillside to a foreign air force scrambling tankers? He also wants to know why this is one of the few domains where politics seems to take a back seat, because the political climate between some of these countries is, let's call it, complicated.
The thing that jumps out at me first is that none of this is ad hoc. Everyone pictures a prime minister calling another prime minister in the middle of the night, and that does happen at the very end, but the scaffolding underneath is bureaucratic and it's been built over decades. The mechanism that actually routes these requests is called the EU Civil Protection Mechanism. That's the central clearinghouse for disaster assistance across Europe and the Mediterranean basin. Israel's not an EU member, but it's a participating state in the mechanism, which means it both sends and receives through the same channels as everyone else.
So it's less a phone tree and more a ticketing system.
Exactly, a ticketing system. A country declares an emergency, assesses what it needs, and submits a formal request for assistance through the EU's Emergency Response Coordination Center in Brussels. That request goes out to all participating states simultaneously. Anyone who can help offers what they've got, the requesting country accepts or declines specific offers, and then the center coordinates logistics. It's not diplomats improvising, it's a protocol.
And Israel signed on to this when?
The agreement was signed in 2008, though the relationship had been building since the late 90s. Israel's actually been one of the more active non-EU participants. They've sent firefighting planes to Greece in 2021, to Cyprus multiple times. They received help from Greece and Italy during the Carmel fire in 2010. That one's instructive because it was the disaster that exposed how under-equipped Israel's fire service was. They had exactly zero dedicated firefighting aircraft at the time.
As zero?
Zero. They were using crop dusters retrofitted with water tanks. The Carmel fire killed 44 people, mostly prison service cadets whose bus got trapped on the road. After that, the government bought a fleet of air tractor planes and formed the ELAD squadron. That's the Aerial Firefighting Unit. But during the fire itself, they were completely dependent on foreign assistance, and the requests went out through channels that were far less organized than what exists now.
So the modern system was forged in the failure of the old one. There's a pattern.
It's the pattern for most of emergency management, honestly. The other piece Daniel mentioned is earthquake response, and that's a different mechanism entirely, that runs through INSEROG, the International Search and Rescue Advisory Group, which operates under the UN. Israel's National Rescue Unit, the Home Front Command Search and Rescue Brigade, is one of only a handful of teams worldwide that's INSEROG classified at the heavy level, meaning they can deploy a fully self-sufficient field hospital with surgical capacity within hours of an earthquake anywhere in the world.
And heavy classification means what, practically?
It means they don't need anything from the host country. They bring their own water, power, food, medical supplies, satellite communications. They can operate for 2 weeks without resupply. The classification audit is brutal. International evaluators show up unannounced and run a 36-hour simulation. If your field hospital's water purification fails, you get downgraded. Israel's held the heavy classification continuously since 2010.
So there's a reputational incentive baked into the system. You don't just help because it's the right thing to do. You help because maintaining that classification is a national asset.
And it's not just reputation. Being INSEROG classified means your teams get priority access to disaster zones. When the Haiti earthquake hit in 2010, the airport at Port-au-Prince was chaos. The control tower was destroyed. There was no fuel. Planes were circling. The UN prioritized landing slots for NSARAG classified teams. Israel's field hospital was on the ground and treating patients within something like 38 hours of the quake, and it ended up being the largest field hospital operating in Haiti. They treated over 1,000 patients, performed more than 300 surgeries.
That's the part that doesn't make the news. The logistics of who lands first.
The Haiti deployment is actually a case study in how this works at the diplomatic level. Israel and Haiti didn't have particularly warm relations. They still don't. But when the request went out through INSARAG channels, Israel offered a field hospital, Haiti accepted, and the whole thing was coordinated through the UN's On-Site Operations Coordination Center. The politics got checked at the door because the mechanism doesn't have a field for how do we feel about this country.
Daniel's question, though he's asking about the declaration itself, what actually constitutes an emergency that triggers this? Because there's a spectrum between we have a fire and we're formally requesting international assistance.
Right, and that threshold is entirely set by the requesting country. There's no external authority that declares a country is officially overwhelmed. It's a sovereign decision. The government assesses that the incident exceeds domestic capacity, either in scale, in specialized equipment needed, or in duration, and they activate the mechanism. For fires, it's often about aerial assets specifically. Most countries could put boots on the ground, but the number of countries that maintain a fleet of heavy firefighting aircraft is tiny.
How tiny?
Globally, maybe 15 countries have dedicated large air tankers. Everyone else relies on helicopters with buckets or smaller single-engine planes. So when a fire gets big enough that you need a Beriev or a Canadair dropping 30,000 liters per pass, you're calling abroad no matter how good your domestic fire service is. Greece has a large Canadair fleet, and they still request assistance almost every bad fire season because the demand outstrips even their capacity.
So the request isn't an admission of failure. It's a recognition that some assets only exist at the multinational level.
And that's the quiet shift that's happened over the last 20 years. Disaster response used to be framed as self-sufficiency. A capable country handles its own emergencies. Now the assumption is that extreme events exceed any single country's capacity, and the mark of a capable country is knowing how to request help fast and integrate foreign assets smoothly.
Which brings us to the politics. Daniel's observation is that this is one of the few domains where countries put politics aside. Is that actually true, or is it just the story we tell?
It's mostly true, with asterisks. The mechanism itself is apolitical. When Greece submitted its request for assistance during the 2021 fires, the offer list included countries with whom Greece had active diplomatic tensions. But here's the asterisk. Countries still get to choose whose help they accept. The mechanism circulates all offers, and the requesting country picks. So if there's a country whose presence would be politically untenable domestically, they just don't make the acceptance call.
So the politics doesn't block the offer. It filters the acceptance.
And that's why the system works. No one loses face by offering, and no one's forced to host a country they can't stomach. The offers circulate anonymously in the initial round. Actually, the requesting country sees capabilities and timelines before they see flags.
That's a clever piece of design. Depoliticize the first pass. Let the operational need drive the shortlist, and only then do the political calculations.
It's a lesson from decades of disaster diplomacy failures. There's a whole academic literature on this. Disaster diplomacy. And the core finding is that disaster response almost never creates lasting diplomatic breakthroughs. The cooperation is real and genuine in the moment, but it doesn't resolve underlying conflicts. Greece and Turkey have exchanged firefighting assistance multiple times while in active disputes over airspace and maritime boundaries. The planes land, they drop water, they go home, and the next day the rhetoric resumes.
So it's a temporary suspension, not a thaw.
A ceasefire in the argument, not a resolution. And that's fine. It doesn't need to be more than that. The point is that the mechanism creates a space where the suspension is possible without anyone having to make a grand political gesture. You're not signing a peace accord, you're accepting a water bomber.
What about the Israeli side specifically? You mentioned the Carmel fire was a turning point. What's the domestic architecture now?
The National Emergency Management Authority. Nima, or in Hebrew Rachel, sits under the Ministry of Defense and coordinates all domestic disaster response. They're the ones who would assess whether to request international assistance. The trigger is typically when the incident commander on the ground reports that available resources are insufficient for the projected escalation. That goes up through the Fire and Rescue Authority to NEMA, and NEMA makes the call to activate the EU mechanism. For outbound assistance, Israel offering help elsewhere. The process runs through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Defense jointly. The Foreign Ministry handles the diplomatic offer. The Defense Ministry handles the operational deployment.
And there's a political calculus on the outbound side too, presumably.
Of course. Israel offers assistance strategically. It's not purely altruistic. No country's disaster response is. There's a soft power dimension. The Haiti Field Hospital generated more positive international coverage for Israel than any deliberate PR campaign could have bought. But the calculus is also operational. Every deployment is a training exercise for the home front command. You can't simulate the chaos of a real earthquake zone. The only way to maintain readiness is to deploy to actual disasters.
So the receiving country gets a field hospital, and Israel gets a live fire training exercise that also happens to generate goodwill. That's a remarkably efficient transaction.
It's the definition of mutual benefit, and it explains why countries maintain these capabilities even when they're expensive. Israel's heavy search and rescue classification costs millions annually to maintain. Equipment, training, readiness exercises. But the alternative is losing the capability entirely, and then, when the next Haiti happens, you're not in the game.
Let me push on something. You said the mechanism is apolitical, and I believe that's true of the EU Civil Protection Mechanism and INSERAG at the operational level. But the decision to offer assistance in the first place, that's a political decision made by a government. Is there ever a case where a country that could help simply doesn't offer?
Yes, and that's the limit of the system. The mechanism only works if countries choose to participate. It doesn't compel anyone to offer. During the 2023 Turkish earthquakes, the offers flooded in from over 100 countries. But there have been disasters in less geopolitically convenient places where the response was sparse. The mechanism is a routing system. It doesn't create political will where none exists.
So it accelerates and organizes generosity that's already there, but it can't manufacture it.
And that's why the pre-existing relationships matter so much. The Eastern Mediterranean Fire Cooperation works partly because the countries involved all face the same threat. Greece, Israel, Cyprus, Italy, Turkey. They all burn in the same season from the same weather patterns. There's a shared interest that predates any political alignment. When the winds are blowing from the same direction and the fuel loads are the same, you develop a professional kinship that operates beneath the political surface.
The fire chiefs know each other.
They do. They train together. There are joint exercises under the EU mechanism. The operational people build relationships that then make the political decisions easier. When the request comes in, the fire commissioner can tell the minister, "I know these people, they're professional, we can work with them." That personal trust at the operational level is the grease that makes the whole thing move.
Daniel also mentioned earthquakes specifically. Is the mechanism different for sudden onset disasters versus fires, which have some lead time?
The fundamental difference is speed. A fire typically builds over hours or days. You can see the forecasts. You know when the conditions are dangerous. You can pre-position assets. Earthquakes are instantaneous. The INSERAG system is designed for a response that begins literally within minutes of the event. Teams are on standby rotation. Israel's Home Front Command maintains a team that can be wheels up within 4 hours of a formal request. And the request process is compressed accordingly. For earthquakes, there's a pre-approved framework. Countries don't negotiate each deployment from scratch. The heavy classified teams have standing agreements about airspace clearance, landing rights, customs waivers for equipment.
4 hours from request to wheels up is... That's not a lot of time to brief a prime minister.
That's why the authority is delegated. The defense minister or the home front command chief has pre-authorized deployment for certain categories of disaster. They don't need to wake anyone up. The offer goes out through the foreign ministry's situation room, which is staffed 24/7, and the operational order goes to the unit simultaneously. By the time the political leadership is fully briefed, the advance team is already at the airbase loading equipment.
That level of delegated authority is itself a statement about how seriously a country takes this.
It's a statement about lessons learned. Every country that's been caught flat-footed by a disaster eventually builds faster authorization chains. The countries that haven't been through it yet still have the slow ones.
You mentioned the 2023 Turkish earthquakes. Israel sent teams to Turkey despite, let's say, a complicated bilateral relationship at the time.
They did, and Turkey accepted. That deployment was interesting because it went through both mechanisms simultaneously. The search and rescue teams deployed under INSERAG, and additional humanitarian aid flowed through bilateral channels. The political relationship at the time was strained, but the operational relationship between the disaster response communities was intact. The Homefront Command team operated in the Adıyaman region and extracted something like 19 people from collapsed buildings.
19 lives pulled out of rubble, and the political relationship didn't improve one degree.
Not one degree. And both sides understood that going in. The deployment wasn't framed as a diplomatic overture, it was framed as a professional obligation. Israel has a capability, Turkey had a need, the mechanism routed the request, and the professionals did their jobs. The politicians stayed out of it except for the initial authorization.
That's almost more interesting than if it had led to a thaw. It suggests the mechanism is robust enough to function, even when the political temperature is at its coldest.
That's the thesis of the whole disaster diplomacy literature. The cooperation is genuine but contained. It doesn't spill over into other domains. And that's not a failure. It's the design spec. You want a system that works regardless of the political weather, not one that only works when the sun is shining.
Let's talk about the actual assets for a minute. What does Israel send when it responds to a fire abroad?
The primary asset is the ELAD squadron. That's the air tractor fleet, single-engine firefighting planes. They're small. Each one carries about 3,000 liters of water or retardant, but they operate in formations of 4 to 8 aircraft, and they're extremely maneuverable in mountainous terrain. For larger deployments, Israel also has C-130 transport planes that can be configured for aerial firefighting with modular systems. And then there's the ground component, firefighting teams from the Fire and Rescue Authority who deploy as advisors or to coordinate with local crews.
And the cost? Who pays?
It depends on the mechanism. Under the EU Civil Protection Mechanism, the requesting country covers operational costs, fuel, logistics, basing. The sending country covers personnel and equipment. There's also an EU funding pool that can cover transport costs for particularly expensive deployments. Bilaterally, it's negotiated case by case. Israel has sent assistance to countries without billing them when the diplomatic value justified the expense.
Has Israel ever declined a request?
Not publicly that I'm aware of, but the mechanism allows it. A country can always say its assets are committed elsewhere or unavailable. The system doesn't require explanations.
And the other direction. When Israel requests help, what's the most common offer?
Aerial assets, almost always. Israel's fire season is the same as the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean, so the same planes that are fighting fires in Greece in July might be needed in Israel in August. The coordination challenge is that everyone's peak demand overlaps. When Greece is burning, Israel might also be burning, and then the pool of available aircraft shrinks to whatever's not already committed. That's the inherent tension in a regional mutual aid system. The need is simultaneous.
So, the system works best for the second fire of the season, not the first.
That's a dark way to put it, but yes. The first major fire catches everyone, and then the assets rotate to whoever's next. There's been talk of a pre-positioned regional firefighting fleet, a standing multinational squadron of large air tankers based in Cyprus or Crete that would be available to all participating countries. It hasn't happened yet, mostly because of cost. A single Canadair costs about $35 million, and a standing fleet of 6 would need annual operating budgets in the tens of millions. Nobody wants to be the country that foots the bill.
The classic collective action problem. Everyone benefits. No one wants to pay.
And it's worse than usual because the benefit is probabilistic. You might not need the planes this year, or you might need them desperately. Budgeting for a maybe is politically harder than responding to an actual emergency, even though the latter costs more.
That's the fundamental irrationality of disaster funding. We'll spend $100 million responding to a fire, but not $10 million preventing it.
Prevention doesn't have a ribbon-cutting ceremony. There's no photo op for the fire that didn't happen.
All right, let me pull us back to Daniel's core question. He wants to know how the declaration and offer process operates at the practical and diplomatic levels. We've covered the mechanisms. What does the actual sequence look like, minute by minute, when a fire crosses the threshold?
I'll walk through a hypothetical based on how these have actually played out. Say it's mid-August, the Judean Hills, a fire's been burning for 6 hours and the wind shifts. The incident commander on the ground determines that available aerial assets, Israel's own ELAD squadron, can't contain the spread. That assessment goes to the Fire and Rescue Authority's Operations Center, which contacts NEMA. NEMA's director consults with the fire commissioner and the Ministry of Defense. If they concur that domestic capacity is insufficient, NEMA contacts the Israeli liaison at the EU's Emergency Response Coordination Center in Brussels.
And that liaison is a permanent position.
Yes, Israel maintains a permanent representative to the ERCC. That person submits the formal request for assistance, specifying what's needed, typically heavy air tankers, possibly ground crews with specialized equipment. The ERCC broadcasts the request to all participating states within minutes. The request includes the operational parameters, location, fuel availability, basing options, expected duration. Countries respond with offers. Greece offers 2 Canadairs. Italy offers 1. Cyprus offers a ground team. The offers come with timelines. Wheels up in 3 hours, on station in 6.
And Israel picks?
Israel's operations center evaluates the offers against the operational need and accepts the ones that fit. The ERCC coordinates the logistics, flight paths, landing clearances, fuel arrangements. The sending country's aircraft take off, and the receiving country's air force provides escort and integration into their airspace. The whole thing, from initial assessment to foreign aircraft on station, can happen in under 12 hours.
12 hours from "we can't handle this" to foreign planes dropping water. That's the part that should impress people.
It's remarkable. And it works because every step has been rehearsed. There are tabletop exercises, there are live drills, there are after-action reviews of every deployment. The system isn't improvised, it's engineered.
So when Daniel looks at this and sees politics being put aside, what he's actually seeing is a parallel system that's been deliberately insulated from politics.
Yes. The politics isn't put aside, it's bypassed. The mechanism creates a channel that runs underneath the political layer. The operational people have their own relationships, their own protocols, their own decision-making authority. The politicians are involved only at the authorization points. Should we offer help? Should we accept help? Once those gates are passed, the professionals run the show.
And the gates themselves are designed to be low friction. Pre-authorized, delegated, rehearsed.
Because the alternative is what happened before these mechanisms existed, the Carmel fire, where the Prime Minister was personally calling foreign leaders asking for planes while the fire was still spreading. That's not a system. That's panic with a phone.
There's a deeper question here that Daniel's prompt gestures at, but doesn't quite ask. Why does this domain get the bypass when so many others don't? What's special about disaster response that lets it operate below the political radar?
I think there are 3 things. First, the threat is shared and visible. Everyone in the Eastern Mediterranean watches the same forest burn. There's no ambiguity about whether the problem is real. Second, the response is time-critical in a way that most government functions aren't. You can argue about trade policy for 6 months. You can't argue about water bombers for 6 hours. The urgency forces a different decision-making mode. And third, the operational communities are small and professionalized. The people who run fire services and search and rescue teams in different countries speak the same technical language. They've trained together, they've deployed together, they know each other's capabilities. That professional trust exists independently of whatever the foreign ministries are saying about each other.
So it's shared threat, compressed timeline, and pre-existing professional trust, none of which applies to, say, trade negotiations.
And that's why disaster diplomacy doesn't generalize. People keep hoping it will, that the cooperation will spill over, that the goodwill will create openings for broader diplomatic progress. The evidence says it doesn't. But that's not a criticism of the mechanism. The mechanism isn't trying to solve political problems. It's trying to put out fires and pull people out of collapsed buildings. And on those terms, it works.
The mechanism is a tool, not a metaphor.
Right. And treating it as a metaphor for what could be possible in other domains actually undersells what's impressive about it. The impressive thing isn't that it might lead to peace. It's that it works even when there's no peace.
All right. I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the Insrag classification system. You said Israel is one of only a handful of heavy classified teams. Who else is in that club?
The heavy classification is held by about 20 teams worldwide. The U.S. has two, USAID's Disaster Assistance Response Team and the Fairfax County Urban Search and Rescue Team. The U.K. has one. Australia has one. The Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, Singapore, China, Russia. It's a small group. And the classification isn't permanent. Teams get reevaluated every 5 years. If you fail the reevaluation, you lose the classification and the priority access that comes with it.
Have teams ever been downgraded?
Yes. I don't have the full list, but it happens. Equipment failures during the evaluation exercise, communication breakdowns, logistics shortfalls. The evaluators are unforgiving because the stakes in a real deployment are unforgiving. If your water purification fails during the exercise, you fix it and try again. If it fails in a disaster zone, people die.
That's the right kind of unforgiving.
It's the only kind that makes sense. The INSARAG system was built after the 1988 Armenian earthquake, which was a turning point in international disaster response. The Soviet Union accepted international assistance for the first time since World War II, and the response was chaotic. Teams showed up without coordination, without compatible equipment, without self-sufficiency. Some teams became a burden on the host country rather than an asset. INSARAG was created specifically to prevent that from happening again.
So the whole edifice is built on a Soviet disaster that exposed how broken the ad hoc approach was. There's a kind of poetry in that.
The best international systems are almost always built on the ashes of the worst failures. Nobody designs coordination mechanisms because they're fun. They designed them because the alternative got people killed.
They charged me for the fuel.
Sorry?
The fuel. I was on a deployment in the late 90s, not in Sarag. This was before the classification system was fully stood up. I was with a private contractor doing logistics for one of the NGOs. We flew into a disaster zone with a plane full of water purification gear, and the host country charged us for the aviation fuel. Market rate. They wouldn't release the plane until someone paid.
Where was this?
I'm not gonna say. It's not the point. The point is the mechanism Daniel's asking about. The one where everything's pre-cleared and the customs waivers are signed and the fuel is comped. That didn't exist. You showed up and you negotiated. With the airport manager, with the local military commander, with whoever had the keys to the fuel truck. And they knew you were desperate, so they named their price.
So the system we've been describing as impressively bureaucratic is actually the solution to a much uglier problem.
The bureaucracy is the feature. Everyone thinks it's the obstacle. It's not. The obstacle is showing up in a country where you have no standing and trying to get a water pump through customs while a guy with a gun wants to know what's in the crates. The forms, the pre-clearances, the standing agreements, those are what make the guy with the gun step aside.
That's the part the public never sees. They see the planes dropping water and they think the heroism is in the flying. The heroism is in the customs paperwork that was signed 3 years earlier.
We eventually got the fuel paid. The NGO's country director had to wire money from Geneva. Took 2 days. The water purification gear sat on the tarmac while people downstream were drinking contaminated water. That's what the mechanism fixes. Not the flying. The waiting.
2 days.
2 days. And that was fast for the time. I knew teams that were stuck for a week.
That experience, that specific experience of watching equipment sit idle while people needed it, is why INSARAG built the customs waiver into the classification requirements. Heavy classified teams have to demonstrate that they can clear their equipment through a simulated customs checkpoint in under 2 hours. The evaluators literally set up a fake customs desk and time it.
2 hours. We'd have killed for 2 hours.
Hilbert, how did you end up doing logistics for an NGO in disaster zones?
I was between things. A guy I knew from the Merchant Marine needed someone who could drive a forklift and speak French. I can't speak French, but I can drive a forklift.
Wait, you were in the Merchant Marine?
Briefly. I was 19. The less said about it, the better. The forklift certification outlasted the maritime career.
That got you into disaster zones.
The world runs on people who can drive forklifts and don't ask too many questions about where they're going. I did 3 deployments. The fuel incident was the second one. After the third one, I decided the problem wasn't the disasters, it was the logistics, and I didn't want to spend my life being the guy who could have helped if only someone had signed the right form. So I got out.
Now you produce a podcast.
It's indoor work, the fuel is included.
There's something in what Hilbert's describing that connects back to Daniel's question about politics. The guy with the gun at the airport, he's not being political, he's being opportunistic. The politics doesn't block the aid, the chaos does. And the mechanism we've been praising is essentially a chaos reduction system.
That's a better framing than putting politics aside. The mechanism doesn't solve politics, it solves chaos. And chaos is what kills people in the first 48 hours of a disaster, not politics, not even the disaster itself. It's the inability to get the right equipment to the right place because someone's arguing about fuel payments.
Or because the landing strip is too short and nobody thought to check. Or because the water purification tablets are in Crate 7 and Crate 7 is on a different plane. Or because the local commander doesn't trust foreigners and wants to inspect every box.
How many ways can it go wrong?
All of them. Every way you can think of and 12 you can't. The mechanism eliminates maybe half. The other half you still have to solve on the ground. But half is a lot better than none.
That's the honest answer to Daniel's question. The declaration and offer process works because it's been designed to eliminate the preventable failures. The unpreventable ones. The weather, the terrain, the fire behavior. Those you still have to fight, but at least you're fighting them with the right equipment, on time, without having to wire money from Geneva.
The mechanism is a force multiplier for the thing that actually matters, which is getting water on the fire and medics in the rubble.
It's worth noting that the mechanism keeps improving. Every deployment generates an after-action report. The reports feed into the next revision of the protocols. The system learns. It's not static. The customs waiver that Hilbert didn't have in the 90s is now a standard NSARAG requirement. The fuel payment problem is solved by pre-negotiated host country support agreements. Each failure becomes a new paragraph in the checklist.
The checklist is a fossil record of past disasters.
That's exactly what it is. Every line item is something that went wrong once and killed people, and now it won't go wrong again because the checklist says to check it.
The checklist doesn't cover everything.
No checklist covers everything.
I'm just saying. The checklist is good. It's better than what we had. But the thing that actually goes wrong is never the thing you prepared for. It's the thing 3 steps to the left of what you prepared for. The mechanism handles the known unknowns. The unknown unknowns still show up and ruin your day.
That's either deeply cynical or deeply realistic.
It's both. That's the job.
The question Daniel's really asking, I think, is whether this system represents something hopeful, a model for international cooperation that works despite everything. And I think the answer is yes, but only if you're clear-eyed about what it is and what it isn't. It's a logistics mechanism. It moves planes and personnel and equipment across borders efficiently. That's all it does. It doesn't build peace. It doesn't resolve conflicts. It doesn't create lasting diplomatic goodwill. But moving planes across borders efficiently when forests are burning isn't a small thing. It's an impressive achievement of international coordination.
It's built on the least glamorous thing imaginable. Paperwork, forms, waivers, pre-clearances, standing agreements. The heroism is in the bureaucracy.
The heroism is in the bureaucracy. I'm going to remember that.
Daniel's prompt came in asking us to look at the practical and diplomatic levels of how this works. I think what we've landed on is that the practical level and the diplomatic level are the same thing. The forms are the diplomacy. The customs waiver is the diplomatic agreement. The pre-negotiated fuel arrangement is the treaty. The mechanism doesn't bypass politics. It encodes the political agreement into operational procedures so that when the emergency hits, nobody has to negotiate anything.
That's well put. The diplomacy happens in advance, during the exercises and the protocol negotiations, so that during the disaster there's no diplomacy required, just operations.
The reason it works for fires and earthquakes but not for trade or borders is that fires and earthquakes have an operational solution. You need planes and medics. Trade disputes and border conflicts don't have an operational solution. They require political choices that can't be pre-negotiated into a checklist.
The checklist works when the problem is, how do we get this thing to this place? It doesn't work when the problem is, what do we want? Disaster response is entirely about the first question. Most international disputes are about the second.
That's the boundary of the mechanism, and it's a hard one. But inside that boundary, it's remarkable what's been built.
It is, and it keeps getting better. The next iteration, if the regional firefighting fleet ever gets funded, would be a genuine leap forward, pre-positioned assets that don't depend on any one country's availability. That's the direction this is heading, from ad hoc phone calls to standing mechanisms to shared capabilities.
Daniel, if you're listening, the short answer is that the system works because it's been engineered to work. By people who learn the hard way what happens when it doesn't. The politics isn't put aside. It's pre-resolved. The cooperation is real but contained. And the whole thing runs on forms that were written in the aftermath of disasters where the forms didn't exist and people died waiting.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop, who has driven a forklift in more countries than I've visited and apparently still thinks about the fuel bill.
If you want to send us a prompt, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.